Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're in the last debates on the ratification of the federal Constitution. This is North Carolina. And this is one, you know, well, actually, I like the debates, but I think my favorite is Virginia. North Carolina and Massachusetts are very, very good, too. So, I mean, it's just like, well, Paul, we got Paul with us. And so, Paul, what now that you've almost read all of them other than this one, have you favored any over another or what have you, based on the information and the insights provided?
So far, I've been pretty impressed with the North Carolina debates. Mm-hmm. I really like the points that they have brought up. And like you, I've gotten a lot from Virginia and Massachusetts. You're really familiar with them. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be reading them again on my own. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, you know, sort of like you read the Bible more than once.
Yep.
The Constitution and the ratification debates, that's that kind of material.
Right. Right. So anyway, what we're going to go through with the North Carolina debates, we've got a lot still to go, and we've probably got at least, I'm going to say, we're going into next week easy, since I see more than 3 days worth of work here. But where we left off with Mr. Iredell talking about delegated powers and the militia. And, you know, over the course of the next couple of pages, as he's wrapping up towards the end of his oration, he makes some points regarding common law and impeachments. Now, I say this, but I really need to lay this out before we read this. The paradigm at that point in time was, you know, that they were creating a system that they didn't see could be so corrupted, that they didn't understand the integrity of a person could actually become less than the type of integrity and honor that they had in their lives. And I honestly believe that even during the Civil War, it was not necessarily common. However, what is dubbed as the Radical Republicans that gave us the 14th Amendment, they clearly saw that the oath of office and the current system of impeachment through, you know, their ethics boards or committees and so forth was insufficient. Mm-hmm. And especially because they realized that, you know, the damage that was done by the states seceding instead of just, you know, peacefully getting rid of slavery, because it was really about slavery. Any person, folks, if you don't believe that these states seceded over slavery, the 4 secession letters out there on the Avalon Project clearly state that. I mean, that's the first thing they say is we're seceding because of slavery. You're trying to take this away from us.
I think they were seceding before Lincoln was even inaugurated, weren't they?
So
they started in 1860.
Yeah, the secession and the nullification of those types of things actually started in the 30s. The concept and because Madison in his notes on nullification clearly stated that if a state wanted to try to nullify federal laws, the only way they could do that legitimately is by seceding. And any state can secede if they feel like the union is violating the Constitution and violating their rights appertaining to, you know, them, the state and their people. So when we look at this, you know, this was all set to boil over because of that Missouri Compromise. The Missouri Compromise made it impossible to get rid of slavery, and because we were heading down that path. And so by the time the pressures mounted, you got to remember that when when Van Buren, and this was under John Quincy Adams' presidency, when Van Buren invoked the gag order on slavery. In other words, they would not address or redress any grievances regarding slavery issues that came in First Amendment petitions. They banned the dialogue and the discussion, even with First Amendment petitions. So when... in other words, Van Buren actually violated the Constitution.
Was he vice president?
Van Buren, he was vice president under Jackson. But Van Buren was a senator at that time in the Senate when he did that under John Quincy Adams' presidency. So a lot of people know this, that after John Quincy Adams served and got unseated by Andrew Jackson, he didn't do what every other president did. He actually went back into the service of the state of Massachusetts over suffrage, or actually over the abolition movement, and remained as a U.S. senator for the rest of his life. It's the only... most people don't understand the magnitude of that. That's how powerful his drive, his focus, his effort, his concern over this abomination called slavery and what was going on. And so he was really organizing the anti-slavery movement and trying to work forward. And it was under his, you know, leadership in the Senate and in Congress that where they actually started creating, using creativity in laws and tariffs that would strictly hurt the South. Which is why in the 1830s, John C. Calhoun, a senator in the U.S. Senate, as well as, you know, other state representatives, really started complaining to say, hey, this is unconstitutional. We're going to nullify these. And that's what caused the notes on nullification. And it was really, if I remember part of it was to communicate to Monroe, you know, the nuances of the interposition versus nullification and why it was more important that the states pulled together to nullify unconstitutional laws. I don't think Madison was necessarily trying to, you know, support. I think he was really more supporting the interposition on, you know, the constitutional support of slavery. But, you know, because it was... I don't know if you knew this, but Madison actually had the desire to free his slaves after he died, but he couldn't do that. He saw what happened to Washington and how Martha had to let them go because an insurrection was occurring, you know, shortly after he died on their estate. So, and rightfully so. So, you know, Madison, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I guess you're describing something that's, I think, not well known. Okay, I think to some people we've heard that Washington freed his slaves and he celebrated for that. But for some reason, something happened that maybe most of us don't know about. Right. You mentioned an insurrection. What actually, if you got a minute, what actually happened?
Well, so in his will, he basically put it in writing that on the passing of Martha, that his slaves would be freed. They would become free men. And so, you know, people talk about how, you know, he was a slave owner and everything else. And he never had children. Martha, right. I think, had children in a previous marriage. But he never had children. And so if you ever read Ron Chernow's biography, and there's other biographies out there that account for this, I mean, Washington loved his slaves like they were his children. He took care of them. I mean, we see this connotation of whip marks and everything else. He actually treated them like his children and protected them. And he had to, unfortunately, live within the parameters of property. So when a slave would run away, you know, it really hurt him to the core because why would they do that? Do they not know that, you know, under the hand of another master, they will be beaten and, you know, and brutalized, you know? And so he was pretty lenient in, you know, their behavior, if that makes sense. He wasn't a hard hand. When you look at how Washington treated his troops, he didn't think second about shooting a guy that ran away from the front lines in the back. Didn't even think second about it. Put that man down.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to his slaves, that was family. And he really, and there's accounts for when his slaves were sick, he took care of them through the night.
Mm.
He stayed up with them and tended to them. I mean, they did, you know, their medical procedures and processes really sucked. So, I mean, he was either applying leeches or whatever the applications du jour were. But
right.
This man, you know, was not what you would be, you know, what we would consider the epitome of a petty tyrant slave master. He was he was completely different. He was a godly man, and, you know, he, like I said, he loved them. It was his extended family. If there was anybody that he had those types of affections for, it was his slaves.
So what was the insurrection you mentioned?
So after he died, and it was in the will, there was a, well, you know, our freedom is contingent upon her dying. Well, let's expedite that.
Sure.
And so there, you know, as it became more and more evident, because Martha didn't treat him the same.
Mm-hmm.
The way Martha, she had her own slaves, and Washington had his. And, you know, again, it was property. It was almost like, you know, stepchildren, that relationship. But, you know, Martha had children where she had that, you know, that bond with, you know, of nurturing and so forth. So she didn't feel inclined to nurture her slaves where George Washington did.
Right.
I mean, their wants were taken care of. They were well fed. They were well clothed. Their quarters were, you know, very good. It wasn't the same as family. I'm not trying to, but if you look at how companies treat employees, mm-hmm. and these were, you know, basically subjugated employees, he still treated them with dignity and respect and everything else. And so when one or two would run away, you know, he went and pleaded to them, please come back. I mean, I don't want to see, you know, you under the hand of a tyrant.
Wow. I see what you're saying. But Martha had her own children. She didn't. I understand the difference. Okay.
Right.
She had her own connections. So slaves were different to her. Sounds like you're saying they rebelled against Martha.
Oh yeah, precisely. As a matter of fact, there were a few different plans that were concocted to take her life.
Wow.
And so when she finally realized, you know, this isn't just a, you know, accident. I mean, you know, I'm not just befalling upon bad luck here. I, you know, there's a conspiracy here. I don't know if her slaves spoke up or anything like that. I don't know. Because I never read anything, but, you know, logical deduction would be that she probably didn't treat those, you know, her slaves like Washington did, where she had that relationship where, in other words, I don't think her slaves would have been willing to speak up because they probably thought, you know, hey, if they go free, we might be able to go free, too, because who knows who's whose.
Right.
I don't know. All I know is she ended up, you know, instead of dying and them being free, she ended up freeing them so that they would no longer be present, you know, on the estate, on the Mount Vernon estate, to threaten her life. So,
correct.
Anyway, but we digress. We got 10 minutes to do this on common law, this one paragraph, and maybe we can get in the militia, which is an anti-federalist statement. But anyway, let's go ahead. The power of impeachment.
Yeah, well, thanks for answering my question.
No problem.
Those things just kind of stood out for me. So we're at common law. Mr. Iredell, the power of impeachment is given by this Constitution to bring great offenders to punishment. It is calculated to bring them to punishment for crime, which it is not easy to describe, but which everyone must be convinced is a high crime and misdemeanor against the government. This power is lodged in those who represent the great body of the people because the occasion for its exercise will arise from acts of great injury to the community. and the objects of it may be such as cannot be easily reached by an ordinary tribunal. The trial belongs to the Senate, lest an inferior tribunal should be too much awed by so powerful an accuser. After trial, thus solemnly conducted, it is not probable that it would happen once in 1,000 times that a man actually convicted would be entitled to mercy. And if the president had the power of pardoning in such a case, this great check upon high officers of state would lose much of its influence. It seems therefore proper that the general power of pardoning should be abridged in this particular instance. The punishment annexed to this conviction on impeachment can only be removal from office and disqualification to hold any place of honor, trust, or profit. But the person convicted is further liable to a trial at common law, and may receive such common law punishment as belongs to a description of such offenses, if it be punishable by that law. I hope, for the reasons I have stated, that the whole of this clause will be approved by the committee. The regulations altogether, in my opinion, are as wisely contrived as they could be. It is impossible for imperfect beings to form a perfect system.
Interesting, right? And so what he's covering here is things that really pertain to President Trump's impeachment, as well as the possibility of the pardoning of Biden or so forth, right?
The pardoning of Biden?
So if you haven't heard the dialogues, there's this possibility that if the Senate and the House, if all of Congress flips to Republican control in the presidential election, and the White House is still maintained by a Democrat, that they can actually still go, whether it be Biden or what have you, that they still go down this path of impeaching Biden, just like if he doesn't run as president, like they did with Trump. See, right. You've heard me say that it is constitutional. If anybody has emoluments, the whole process of impeachment is to remove the emoluments and ban them from positions of profit or, service, period. And so the only reason why you can impeach a former president is because of the title, former president, the compensation. That's an emolument. Those are emoluments. The benefits, the security, all of those things are permanent emoluments. And the process of impeachment is to remove them and to basically lay them out and prostrate them into a criminal court. Well, actually, a common law court specifically, not a civil criminal court, but a common law court for their crimes and punishments. And so all of this really, so when you hear people talk about these different strategies of what might happen if Trump gets convicted or what have you, and there's a Republican wave with the next president, pardon President Trump. He's basically saying that when a president is impeached, they should not and could not be pardoned. Now, I'm not sure if he's talking about an amendment here, because he kind of alludes to that. He doesn't speak specifically of defining the pardon power as limited, nor, a stipulation that impeachments can't be pardoned. It's not there. It's not in the Constitution. And so I think he's basically trying to connect the fact that that's what we need. That would be making the system more perfect.
Right.
So anyway,
that impeachment not be pardoned.
Right. Okay. So now Mr. Miller stands up and kind of goes on to the militia and basically refuting or making a comment with Mr. Iredell. And then, as you can see, it goes from Mr. Miller to Mr. Spate to Mr. Porter to Mr. Spate to Mr. Porter to Governor Johnston to Mr. McClain. It just keeps going on. I mean, there's like two pages here of this man says this, this man says this. So why don't you go ahead and read the first one, because we got about 4.5 minutes and we might be able to cover the Mr. Spate. So go ahead.
What is militia AF?
He's an anti-federalist.
Okay. Militia. Okay, Mr. Miller. Acknowledge that the explanation of this clause by the member from Edenton had obviated some objections which he had to it, but still he could not entirely approve of it. He could not see the necessity of vesting this power in the president. He thought that his influence would be too great in the country, and particularly over the military, by being the commander-in-chief of the Army, Navy, and militia. He thought he could too easily abuse such extensive powers, and was of opinion that Congress ought to have power to direct the motions of the Army. He considered it as a defect in the Constitution that it was not expressly provided that Congress should have the direction of the motions of the Army. Mr. Spate answered that it was true that the command of the Army and Navy was given to the President, but that Congress, who had the power of raising armies, could certainly prevent any abuse of that authority by the President, that they alone had the means of supporting armies, and that the President was impeachable if he in any manner abused his trust. He was surprised that any objection should be made to giving the command of the Army to one man, that it was well known that the direction of an army could not be properly exercised by a numerous body of men, that Congress had, in the last war, given the exclusive command of the army to the commander-in-chief, and that if they had not done so, perhaps the independence of America would not have been established.
Yeah,
Mr. Porter.
Go ahead. What I want to do is, you can kind of see how the scribe or the stenographer for Mr. Miller really referred in third person, and then there was a little more first person with Mr. Spate. Now let's look at let's take a look at how the scribe or the stenographer basically wrote what Mr. Porter said.
Mr. Porter. Mr. Chairman, there is a power vested in the Senate and President to make treaties, which shall be the supreme law of the land. Which among us can call them to account? I always thought that there could be no proper exercise of power without the suffrage of the people. Yet the House of Representatives has no power to intermeddle with treaties. The President and seven senators, as nearly as I can remember, can make a treaty which will be of great advantage to the northern states and equal injury to the southern states. They may give up the rivers and territory of the southern states. Yet in the preamble of the Constitution, they say all the people have done it. I should be glad to know what power there is of calling the President and Senate to account.
Okay, so we got just a little over a minute.
Okay.
You noticed that last stenographer really took word for word of what he said. In other words, it was very first person. There was kind of a mixture in the one before that, which was Mr. Spate, and then Mr. Miller. It was really more of a third person speaking. So these are just little nuances that, you know, for the first time, you wouldn't even pick this up. It's usually the second or third time you start noticing the voice changes. But back to the real content and the context here. What they're really doing is they're laying out this argument that the President, as the commander-in-chief, might actually, if he has a sympathetic army, Marine Corps, or, you know, a military force. But you got to remember, is the military force in full occupation? No, the Constitution basically says only during times of war can the army be stood up. The only force that would be in occupation would be the Navy. And I can't see the Navy launching ship attacks in, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and, you know, the interiors.
Right.
The design of the Navy was strictly exterior. So
right.
I understand that there's this concept that they were talking about, but I don't think that Mr. Miller, who I think was the first person started this, I don't think he really understood, you know, the design of really having a very limited army, or I should say a militia federalized. The only purpose for that, so we hit our break. So the only purpose of the militia is to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and to repel invasions. And so bottom line, they don't have the power to form the militia, or they have to federalize the militia and maintain them. So anyway, we'll be right back after this promo. And so we'll dive more into this little dialogue going back and forth regarding impeachments. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so now that we've read, I think, those three comments by those three different stenographers, and now Mr. Spate then comes back and he answers regarding under the Confederation and so forth. So let's go ahead and move forward with this.
Yeah, I want you to notice that Mr. Spate's comments are read as if they're under the third person. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Let me go there. Okay. So Mr. Spate answered that under the Confederation, 2/3 of the states might make treaties, that if the senators from all the states attended when a treaty was about to be made, 2/3 of the states would have a voice in its formation. He added that he would be glad to ask the gentleman what mode there was of calling the present Congress to account. Mr. Porter repeated his objection. He hoped the gentleman would not impose on the House that the president could make treaties with 2/3 of the Senate, that the president in that case voted rather in a legislative than in an executive capacity, which he thought impolitic. Governor Johnston.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Chairman, in my opinion, if there be any difference between this Constitution and the Confederation with respect to treaties, the Constitution is more safe than the Confederation. We know that two members from each state have a right by the Confederation to give the vote of that state, and 2/3 of the states have a right also to make treaties. By this Constitution, 2/3 of the senators cannot make treaties without the concurrence of the president. Here is then an additional guard. The calculation that 7 or 8 senators with the president can make treaties is totally erroneous. 14 is a quorum, 2/3 of which are 10. It is upon the improbable supposition that they will not attend that the objection is founded that 10 men with the president can make treaties. Can it be reasonably supposed that they will not attend when the most important business is agitated, when the interests of their respective states are most immediately affected? And Mr. McLean observed that the gentleman was out of order with his objection, that they had not yet come to the clause which enables the Senate and President to make treaties.
Ah, so finally somebody said, hey, you're jumping ahead. Because it was all about impeachments, and then this was a segue or trying to make that connection. And so it's kind of interesting how you kind of see, you know, this all play out, and then all of a sudden and then they read the second clause of the second section, you know, which I believe we're looking at, you know, because they were talking about impeachments and so forth, and the Senate, you know, having the authority of trying the trial. So I believe that this was Article 1, the second clause in the second section. Now, they're halfway through, and they're still in Article 1.
Right.
Okay. But the bulk of the Constitution is in Article 1. So why is that?
Well, that's where the powers of Congress are.
That's where the powers of the federal government are.
Okay, right.
Okay, so in other words, because we've heard this several times, that only the powers granted to Congress, you know, create those limitations of jurisdiction for the court, jurisdiction for even the treaties, as well as the president.
Right.
Okay. So there, even though these men were explaining things, some of the stuff that they're saying here, you know, didn't necessarily create a faux pas, but they weren't as accurate as, you know, because they actually, if you want to say there were, that was a conflict, you know, when they made these comments, they talked about these treaties, that they could go off and just create these treaties. There was, I think, one or two times, and I know Mr. Nicholas in Virginia clearly stated that they just can't go out and create a treaty. They can only create a treaty in regards to the enumerated powers under their authority. See, the stipulation of a treaty must be that they have the authority to do that.
Right.
And, you know, that gets lost in all of the other debates. So this is why, when you really look at all of the debates and you pull in all of these different things, and so this is how I would envision the definitizing of the Constitution. You would have all of these clarities, but you would have, you know, the, or I should say, all of these insights, and then you would have the, you know, the ultimate clarity, like what Mr. Iredell said, regardless of the treaties, they can only make treaties that are under their authority, which is based upon the enumerations that are, have been delegated by the states. If it's not enumerated, they can't do it. In other words, they can't make a treaty with foreign nations for educational purposes. In other words, exchange, you know, students and those types of things. They don't have any power over education or any involvement.
There is no authority for Biden to make any agreement with a World Health Organization.
Right. It's not only just Biden, but, you know, all of the previous, you know, presidents, whether it be Bush, it doesn't matter. They don't have the authority. This is why the majority of the treaties, this is why we have that one petition. It's the petition number two. The jurisdictional limitation of the federal government is based on the enumerated powers, that they cannot make any treaties that have not been delegated within these powers. Mm-hmm. That's simple. And see, as people start understanding this, you know, this causes a huge paradigm shift. But what this does is it unleashes all of the chains that have been created to, you know, to create this big, powerful monster called the federal government. And it frees the states and the people to do all sorts of things within their respective spheres and within the respect of the union. In other words, the free trade of commerce within the union, all of those things just get unleashed. Anyway. So the next thing we're going to jump into is Mr. Spencer again. He's again an anti-federalist, and he's making the arguments. And I only point this out because when we're actually reading something out of the ratification debates, I predominantly stick to the Federalists, but I include like Mason and others that have been anti-federalists to, you know, include their views, because sometimes their views are very insightful. So go ahead. This is kind of a long one.
Mr. Spencer, jurisdiction. Mr. Chairman, I have objections to this article. They're still speaking of Article 1.
I have no idea. They read these different articles, so they might be. We'll have to determine that by going through.
Okay.
And actually, based on looking ahead, they're talking about inferior courts and districts and so forth. I think they're talking about Article 3. Go ahead.
I object to the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal court in all cases of law and equity arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States, and to the appellate jurisdiction of controversies between citizens of different states, and a few other instances. To these I object because I believe they will be oppressive in their operation. I would wish that the federal court should not interfere or have anything to do with controversies to the decision of which the state judiciaries might be fully competent, nor with such controversies as must carry the people a great way from home. Now, can I stop here for just a moment?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because this may be an argument for the 11th Amendment, right?
Well, so He's laying out very specifically, correct. You're absolutely correct. He's laying out that he sees this problem. He's making, you know, he's creating this galumphery and amalgamation, this mixture of these different parameters of the jurisdiction of the court. And when they started kicking the tires on the Constitution and the court started operating, they did realize that there was a huge problem between matters between a person and another state. So that's why the 11th Amendment really came through, because had they had other problems that they were trying to make political hay here out of the appellate court system and so forth, then that would have been amended too. Or we could look at, you know, is it a problem today? No, the problem is that the federal government is ignoring the 11th Amendment, and they're ignoring their limitations of jurisdiction. They're assuming they have jurisdiction over everything.
So it appears that Mr. Spencer kind of foresaw this.
Yeah, but he wasn't the only one. So this is why, you know, we're actually proving in the ratification debates that in Virginia, and I think it was even in Massachusetts, where they did talk about this appellate problem and or cases between a person of one state and another state. So anyway, go ahead.
With respect to the jurisdiction of eases arising under the Constitution, when we reflect on the very extensive objects of the plan of government, the manner in which they may arise, and the multiplicity of laws that may be made with respect to them, the objection against it will appear to be well-founded. If we consider nothing but the articles of taxation, duties, and excises, and the laws that might be made with respect to these, the eases will be almost infinite. If we consider that it is in contemplation that a stamp duty shall take place throughout the continent, that all contracts shall be on stamp paper, that no contract shall be of validity but what would be thus stamped, these cases will be so many that consequences would be dreadful. It would be necessary to appoint judges to the federal Supreme Court and other inferior departments, and such a number of inferior courts in every district and county with a correspondent number of officers, that it would cost an immense expense without any apparent necessity, which must operate to the distress of the inhabitants. There will be, without any manner of doubt, clashings and animosities between the jurisdiction of the federal courts and of the state courts, so that they will keep the country in hot water. It has been said that the impropriety of this was mentioned by some in the convention. I cannot see the reasons of giving the federal courts jurisdiction in these cases, but I am sure it will occasion great expense unnecessarily. The state judiciaries will have very little to do. It will be almost useless to keep them up. As all officers are to take an oath to support the general government, it will carry everything before it. This will produce that consolidation through the United States which is apprehended. I am sure that I do not see that it is possible to avoid it. I can see no power that can keep up the little remains of the power of the states. Our rights are not guarded. There is no declaration of rights to secure to every member of the society those unalienable rights which ought not to be given up to any government. Such a Bill of Rights would be a check upon men in power. Instead of such a Bill of Rights, the Constitution has a clause which may warrant encroachments on the power of the respective state legislatures. I know it is said that what is not given up to the United States will be retained by the individual states. I know it ought to be so, and should be so understood, but, sir, it is not declared to be so. In the Confederation, it was expressly declared that all rights and powers of any kind whatsoever of the several states, which are not given up to the states, are expressly and absolutely retained to be enjoyed by the states. There ought to be a Bill of Rights, in order that those in power may not step over the boundary between the powers of government and the rights of the people, which they may do when there is nothing to prevent them. They may do so without a Bill of Rights. Notice will not be readily taken of the encroachments of rulers, and they may go a great length before the people are alarmed. Oppression may therefore take place by degrees. But if there were express terms and bounds laid down when these were passed by, the people would take notice of them, and oppressions would not be carried on to such a length. I look upon it, therefore, that there ought to be something to confine the power of this government within its proper boundaries. I know that several writers have said that a Bill of Rights is not necessary in this country, that some states had the knot,
It should have been them. Had them not.
Oh, had them not, and that others had. To these I answer that those states that have them not as bills of rights, strictly so called, have them in the frame of their constitution, which is nearly the same.
Well, now, so Madison would basically contradict that because, excuse me, because some of those states actually granted, you know, general powers instead of enumerated powers. I mean, actually, when we look at the 13 states, there, I don't think there was really any state that actually had an enumerated constitution. And when I look at the states that joined the Union afterwards, you know, in other words, when we actually look at, you know, those states like Vermont, or is it, I think it's Vermont or New Hampshire, Kentucky, Tennessee, and those states, you'll look at what they created in their new constitutions, a more enumerated constitution, and actually formed this, you know, the three branches of government with a bicameral legislative body. In other words, they really started mimicking or copying the U.S. Constitution and incorporating this concept of separations of powers within any government. So that at any level of government, you had a judiciary, an executive, and a legislative. The problem was that they didn't do that into counties. The counties, because a county was a government, they should have instilled this system, which basically created checks and balances.
Right.
And most people just, they marginalized. Well, what county, what is a county going to do? It should be doing everything. You know, the state should only be providing general services to ensure that all counties are treated, you know, with the same, you know, suffrage and the same, you know, respect and so forth. Anyway.
At this point, counties are considered like sub-elements of the states.
Well, at this point, because of the judiciary, they become the administrative. There's a really colorful expletive I could use here, but anyway, they've become an administrative arm or finger of the state government.
Right.
And actually, the counties do not fall under the state legislature. They fall under the executive agencies that have been unconstitutionally formed, like the EPA and, you know, all these other federal agencies that have come down and co-opted the states with money to say, oh, we need you to form this office. We need to do this. And then you're going to regulate this. Folks, this is how they've taken your government from you.
Right.
I can't emphasize enough how, you know, how we all need to just kind of wake up and grow up and say, you know what? The best governing system is one where we have separations of power, even at any level. If you've got a governing body or a governing level of government, then it needs to be divided where you have a separate judiciary, executive, and legislative. And then you start baking in all the other protections by enumerations to ensure that that government is contained with these very specific powers and no general powers whatsoever.
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely. Okay.
All right.
We are, looks like we're down to Mr. Spate again.
Well, actually, it is Mr. Spencer.
Did I miss?
Yeah, right above Mr. Spate is Mr. Spencer. It's a jurisdiction. It's an anti-federalist comment. It would be on page 95, folks.
I'm there.
Okay. And as you notice, that they're reading Article 3, first and second sections. Hold it. That's what we just read. Yeah, I'm sorry. You're right. For some reason, I jumped back up there. You're right. Okay. It's the jurisdiction of the judiciary, which is Mr. Spate. Yes. And then Mr. McClain.
All right, here we go.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the gentleman insinuates that differences existed in the federal constitution respecting the clauses which he objects to. Whoever told him so was wrong, for I declare that in convention the unanimous desire of all was to keep separate and distinct the objects of the general jurisdiction of the federal from that of the state judiciary. I like the way he worded this. I'm just making an observation. Mr. Spade is saying, whoever told he's not saying that Mr. Spencer was wrong. He said, whoever told him so was wrong. All right. That's
right.
That's just kind of
attention. Right.
Anyway, they wish to separate them as judiciously as possible and to consult the ease and convenience of the people. The gentleman objects to the cognizance of all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. This objection is very astonishing. When any government is established, it ought to have power to enforce its laws, or else it might as well have no power. What but that is the use of a judiciary? The gentleman from his profession must know that no government can exist without a judiciary to enforce its laws by distinguishing the disobedient from the rest of the people and imposing sanctions for securing the execution of the laws. As to the inconvenience of distant attendance, Congress has power of establishing inferior tribunals in each state so as to accommodate every citizen. The Congress have it in their power. Will they not do it? Are we to elect men who will wantonly and not necessarily betray us? Okay. Any comment there?
No. I mean, so you obviously I highlighted that part that you recognize is, you know, pretty good and straightforward. And then Mr. McLean actually jumps in and assists in clarifying the same problem. But, you know,
okay.
Bottom line is, you know, I can't emphasize enough, you know, after these few, because we only had a few anti-federalists speak up. When you look at out of the, you know, 200 or, you know, 100 plus delegates in each of these state debates, we really only heard from a very small subsection. And that doesn't mean that these were prevailing thoughts. Majority of the anti-federalist debates were just literally trying to nitpick, you know, on, you know, these little issues that they think that they could exploit as a weakness or a flaw. And these gentlemen kind of really refute that. And they go back to, and bottom line, the constant harping for a Bill of Rights was fully refuted because there was not one state that, I take that back, North Carolina did not ratify the Constitution at that point, because there was not a Bill of Rights. Now, after the Bill of Rights was submitted the following year in the fall, they actually then joined the Union. So, okay.
So the result of this debate was that they didn't reject it, but they didn't ratify it at this time.
Right. Yeah, they didn't come out and say we're not ratifying. They just said, "Well, let's suspend our ultimate vote. And let's see what's happened," because they were in meeting in August, right? They had heard that the Union was moving forward. And it was like one of those things, well, if we don't ratify it, we're not going to join the Union. But if we reject it, we can't.
Right.
So okay. Let's not ratify it. Let's see what they do. And I think they kind of regretted it. It became, I don't know, in some people's minds, it might be a positive view that they didn't rush into the Union, but in another way of thinking, they acknowledged that they were wrong, that they actually should have joined the Union, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Okay. So, in other words, they were it's paralysis by analysis. You know, sometimes you analyze something so much that you can't even make a decision to move forward. So what ends up happening is you say, you know, well, I need more data. We need to look at this more. And that's the paralysis of analysis. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So this is Mr. McLean. Mr. Chairman, I'd hope that some gentleman more capable than myself would have obviated the objections to this part. The objections offered by the gentleman appear to me totally without foundation. He told us that these clauses tended to be a consolidation of the states. I cannot see how the states are to be consolidated by establishing these two clauses. He enumerated a number of cases which would be involved within the cognizance of the federal courts, customs, excises, duties, stamp duties, a stamp on every article and every contract in order to bring all persons into the federal court, and said that they would be necessarily courts in every district and county, which would be attended with numerous and needless expense, for that the state courts could do everything. He went on further and said that there would be a necessity of having sheriffs and other officers in these inferior departments. A wonderful picture indeed, drawn up in a wonderful manner. I will venture to say that the gentleman's suggestions are not warranted by any reasonable construction of the Constitution. The laws can, in general, be executed by the officers of the states. State courts and state officers will, for the most part, probably answer the purpose of Congress as well as any other. But the gentleman says that the state courts will be swallowed up by the federal courts. This is only a general assertion, unsupported by any probable reasons of arguments. The objections of each are separate, and the objects of each are separate and distinct. I suppose that whatever courts there may be, they will be established according to the convenience of the people. This we must suppose from the mode of electing and appointing the members of the government. State officers will as much as possible be employed for one very considerable reason. I mean, to lessen the expense. But he imagines that the oath to be taken by officers will tend to be the subversion of our state governments and of our liberty. Can any government exist without fidelity in its officers? Ought not the officers of every government to give some security for the faithful discharge of their trust? The officers are only to be sworn to support the Constitution, and therefore will only be bound by their oath so far as it shall be strictly pursued. No officer will be bound by his oath to support any act that would violate the principles of the Constitution. You highlighted this here.
I sure did, didn't I?
I'm thinking that maybe you want to add a comment because this is an important thing he points out.
Yep.
It's expected that people who take the oath will support and defend the Constitution.
In a democracy, okay? Let me just say it this way. In a democracy, a public servant answers to their constituents and supports them. In our constitutional republic, all public servants are sworn to legally only support the Constitution. So in other words, if a constituents come along and say, hey, you need to, you know, bring in a government contract so we can have some jobs out here. Well, that's not in the Constitution.
Right.
So when we have public servants that choose to serve others or other things other than the Constitution, in other words, they are violating the principles of the Constitution.
Right. They're violating their oath. And not only that, they brag about it. I brought home the bacon.
That's right.
Well, then.
Yep. In other words, they've come right out and said that I have committed perjury.
Sure. And then you say, you can take that bacon home and stay there.
Yep. Correct. Okay. So we're out of time. And I really appreciate your time for being with us today, Paul. We'll have you back tomorrow to pick up really where we kind of left off. Folks, I hope as we come to the end of these ratification debates over the next 2 weeks, you really start garnering, you know, out of everything, just how well-defined this Constitution was. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.